This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hey there, welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Americans disagree about a lot of things, and it's always going to be that way. But we're betting that most of you would share concerns about these five questions. Are you confident that Social Security and Medicare will be solvent enough to meet the promises when you and your children need them? Do you want to live in a society in which a tiny fraction of the public and a few corporations hold a greater share of the wealth than has ever been in America before? Must your health care cost almost twice as much as it costs your counterparts in every other advanced nation? Why can't the schools of this affluent and admired nation we live in train students not headed for college for realistic careers and stop busting the budgets and burdening the futures of so many who do go on to university? And finally, did we learn anything from the crash of 2008? I mean, how on earth have we allowed our financial sector to accumulate even greater derivative positions than prior to the crash, and to concentrate its assets in even fewer institutions than before, and to take home a massive and unprecedented share of the economy's profits? It's completely crazy. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking about those important questions. We're going to find out what has caused the problem to exist, and most importantly, what it is that we as Americans can do to overcome that and to make lives for all of us a lot better.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Hi, this is John Ondrasik of Five for Fighting, here for RAD, the entertainment industry's voice for road safety. You know, style is a personal thing, and your lifestyle is your business. But if you take it on the road, it becomes everybody's business. So please, plan ahead, designate before you celebrate. Friends, don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service announcement brought to you by RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. Let's hear from an identity thief.
Identities are easy to catch online. I send people an official-looking email pretending to be their bank or credit card company and ask them to confirm their personal information. Books them every time.
Safeguard your personal information on the phone, online, and especially at home, because half of identity theft occurs by someone you think you know. Keep your identity to yourself and take a bite out of crime. Learn more from the National Crime Prevention Council at ncpc.org.
A message from this station, the U.S. Department of Justice, Crime Prevention Coalition of America, and the National Crime Prevention Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. My guest for this part of today's show is James Stone, who's the author of Five Easy Theses, Common Sense Solutions to America's Great Economic Challenges. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here.
I'm sure you did this on purpose. You and I are of an age where we remember the old Jack Nicholson movie, Five Easy Pieces, which had to do with piano pieces, but still kind of foundational things. Tell us a little bit about why five instead of three or eight?
Sure. First of all, it's not a coincidence. Yes, I did like that movie. And because I did feel I had five subjects to talk about, it just seemed right. The word easy is a little facetious here, because what I've tried to do in Five Easy Theses is to lay out political issues that don't seem to get solved at all. So Congress doesn't find them easy. But I think the public should. I think that these have easy, logical answers. They just have no simple political answer. And as for the number five, as opposed to some other, these are the five subjects I felt I'd had some experience in my various careers in dealing with. So, you know, I felt a little more comfortable talking about these five than any others.
Yeah. Well, you've had quite a background in insurance and at the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, so you certainly know whereof you speak. Let's start with Social Security. And this is something I think that it just makes such good sense. I just read something the other day about LeBron James, and somebody was using LeBron James as an example of, you know, I can't remember, is that $115,000 or something that when you stop paying Social Security tax, and you got somebody like LeBron James who's making $115 million, and if he paid whatever the 7.5% is on that extra money, if we all did, there would be a lot more in Social Security for our grandkids.
Sure. And I've never said that it was wrong to raise that limit and collect more from people with big incomes. But it's not a perfect solution. First of all, the very wealthy, you've picked an exception. The very wealthy are people who own companies, and they get their money in unrealized capital gains that just accumulate. It never shows up as income, so they wouldn't be taxed. You're basically taxing high earners and not the very wealthy
if okay.
you raise that cap. But in addition, it's not going to be enough money. It could be enough money today if you got rid of the cap entirely. But I think that we're going to make a lot of progress as a society scientifically in the fight against cancer and heart disease very soon. People now live to be about 80 on average. If we beat cancer and heart disease or even come close to that, people will live well into their 90s. And raising the cap just won't be close to enough to pay for it.
So what do we do?
So nobody wants to do this, but we don't really have any choice. We have to raise the age at which you become eligible for Social Security payments. As you know, people say 70 is the new 60, or it's that kind of change that's occurring in our society where people are working longer, healthy longer, and so we just have to say you retire later, you work longer, and I think that's an inevitable thing to do.
Now, do you
politically
think that,
hard to face.
Do you think there should also be perhaps a limit, an income limitation on whether you can collect Social Security at all?
I have mixed feelings about that. I don't think that anyone who's wealthy above some reasonable limit needs it, but part of the political support from Social Security, and a lot of people who are fans of Social Security will tell me this, is from the fact that it's in part an insurance program and not just a government tax and spend program. So you take away the insurance aspect if some people are ineligible to collect anything, even though they've put in money all their lives, and that loses it some support. So on fairness grounds, I'd be with you. On political grounds, I'm not sure.
Now, why do you think it is, though, that it's such a holy cow? People just constantly are talking about the Social Security lockbox, and they're never going to change it. Are they pandering to everybody in Florida, or what? Why is that there is such reluctance to even talk about making any changes at all?
This has been an issue in which politicians have not looked good. It is very easy to demagogue it and talk about picking on old people. As soon as anyone raises any issue about the money, even in the most sensible, rational way. And so it's been demagogued whenever that comes up, and politicians are therefore afraid to touch it. It's sometimes referred to as the third rail of politics. But, most of the things in my Five Easy Thesis book are things that politicians are afraid to touch. That's kind of the point of the book.
Yeah.
The public can make these things happen if the politicians won't, and that's probably the only way they'll get done.
And how are we going to do that as the public without any particular power?
Yeah, well, democracy is always frustrating in that regard.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks, I only have my one vote and it doesn't change anything. But the truth is that our government is always going to be run and influenced by vested interests, except when the public as a mass rises up and overrules. And the public can do that, and it does throughout history. So it takes a process of education and people agitating for change, understanding the need for change, and eventually you do get a change in mindset and culture, and it does drive the politicians to do what the public demands. Mm.
Well, there is one topic out of the five that people are actually spending a lot more time talking about now than I remember in any other recent election cycle. Bernie Sanders has been at the forefront of this thing, talking about income inequality and the gap between the super rich and everybody else, but particularly the people at the bottom. That's something that it seems now is an okay conversation to have. Are we getting all the facts, though?
Well, I think that actually All of the candidates that are left, three of them, have mentioned it as an issue now. And that's a good thing. When I started writing the book, I didn't know that that would happen. I'm glad to see that in the forefront. And I think it is, in many ways, the most intractable of the issues. The country is drifting very rapidly in what I consider to be a terrible direction, where people talk this year about angry voters. Well, the median income in the United States has not increased since 1974. There's been a huge amount of wealth generated, and it's all gone to the top.
But, you know, where the thing falls apart, though, I think, is when you start looking at your own checkbook and you say, wait a minute, hold on, I've worked really hard, and I don't want somebody taking my money and giving it to somebody else who hasn't worked hard.
Well, as I said, the median income hasn't increased at all. So for most people, they're not going to find that is a problem if you start to change wealth distribution. You're really looking mainly at people who are extremely wealthy. And we don't really tax them now because their wealth comes in the form of unrealized gains. That is, the stock in businesses that they own keeps rising. Their assets keep getting worth more and more. And if we don't tax it along the way, and then we don't tax it at death because that's become unpopular, then we never get it. And we end up with exactly what our founding fathers didn't want when they set up the country, which is an aristocracy.
But if you're talking about
aristocracy,
if you're talking about taxes, though, it sounds like you're saying that the solution is to have more government programs, as opposed to, you know, the teach a man to fish kind of a thing. You know, giving people the capacity to earn more, as opposed to get a bigger handout.
I would love to think that the kind of teaching program education you're talking about would change wealth distribution in this country for the better. But I don't think that's likely. Those are wonderful programs, and I'm for them. They will change income distribution somewhat, and that's good. But to change wealth distribution is much, much harder. Wealth distribution is even more unequal by a lot than income distribution, and it is getting worse much more rapidly. So I wouldn't count on any kind of educational program to fix that. It can only be fixed with taxes, as unpopular as they are.
Talking with James Stone, who's the author of 5 Easy Theses, Common Sense Solution to America's Greatest Economic Challenges. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will keep talking to Jim.
All right, class, let's hear what everyone did this weekend. Jill?
Well, I raised my older sister to a big oak tree. It was at least 100 years old. My mom said I must have set a record or something. And then we went down by a stream and perched up on this huge rock and saw all of these little minnows swimming around way below us. And then I rescued my little brother from an evil slug king who was guarding him at the bush fortress. And my sister and I brought him back to our super twig fort for safety. And then we all laid out and told stories until it got dark. And the Big Dipper led us all the way home.
Wow. Awesome.
Where were you, Jill?
Yeah.
We went to the forest. It's not that far away. Anyone want to come this weekend?
Ask your parents to take you and your friends to the forest this week and find the fun, adventurous you. It's closer than you think. Check out discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Dear Mom and Dad, one thing I've learned in the Army is that when you're lucky enough to get a little time off, you should put it to good use. So I'm taking a moment to write and tell you that I'm fine and doing well. We have good days and bad days over here. We try to remember the good ones and get through the bad ones as best we can. Mostly we have each other, and that's what keeps us going. That and the pride of our commitment to getting the job done, whatever it takes. I miss you all very much and can't wait to get back to life as usual. Please tell everybody hello for me, that I'll be home soon. And Mom, since you asked, if anyone wants to help, just tell them to contact the USO. You can't believe how much they do for us. With love, your son Michael.
The USO depends on the generosity of the American people, people just like you. To find out how you can help, visit us at USO.org. The USO, until everyone comes home.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jim Stone, who's the author of Five Easy Theses, Common Sense Solutions to America's Greatest Economic Challenges. Let's keep moving, since there's only five. I want to get to all three of these.
Sure.
The education system here, I mean, that's something that also that's come up in elections, but it's also probably comes up in pretty much every person's house is, you know, does everybody need to go to college? And can we find something to do productive with people who don't go to college? And is there anything wrong with not going to college? Talk about your thesis.
Sure.
Well, talk about, I guess, before you talk about the thesis, what's wrong and what do you want to do to fix it?
First, let me address what you just said, because realistically, not everybody is going to go to college and get a four-year degree. In fact, 70% of people in this country are not. And we have to accept that that is the reality. It's not going to change rapidly, if at all. And so with that fact in mind, here's what I think is wrong. Our high school system has moved towards one-size-fits-all. That's a big mistake, because it isn't one-size-fits-all. Some are brilliant and will go on to be scientists, and some are going to have occupations that don't require the same kind of education. And we're not providing the kind of vocational and occupational training that the 70% of the population who are not going to get college degrees need. And our college system, which is actually quite good by international standards, is just too expensive. And so while the system provides a good education for those 30% that are lucky enough that they're going to get a BA, the truth is, by the time they're done, that they're saddled with tremendous amounts of debt. So it's not really serving either group very well. So who does it serve? Well, if you're brilliant and rich, it serves you just great.
Well, even if you're just not even brilliant and rich, you'll be fine. You'll be able to get yourself in someplace. I'm just trying to figure out what you do about all this, because it's easy to say, well, let's make education free.
Yeah.
But, you know, unless we go back to the previous topic and increase taxes so that we can make education free, but then if we're putting all those dollars into the education, then we're not going to be able to have it for the social programs for the people who need to eat as opposed to get an education. It's a complicated thing here.
For exactly that reason, that wouldn't be my solution. I imagine a two-part solution. One is to use the kinds of best practices that we know work in the K through 12 system by observing schools that have been creative and done things better, but we don't really use these best practices the way we ought to. That's at the here and now level. What I'd really like to see, though, is universal national service after high school, where people spend a year or two, and if you're not going on to college, you learn a skill, you get your vocational and occupational training then. And if you are going on to college, because you've done this work for the country, you earn credits to help pay for your education when you do go to college. So that's what I'd really like to see. In the meanwhile, I think schools should adopt these, what I consider to be, fairly well-proven best practices.
Such as?
Yeah, I've listed them in the book, but they include, we should have universal schooling before first grade, kindergarten, or even pre-K. We should have longer hours in the schools. They're getting too short. We should have schools where kids get personal attention from teachers. If they get a lot of it at home, it's not all that necessary. But if they don't, it's absolutely necessary that somebody help them understand that doing well in school is a good thing. There's a lot of data-driven administration that's used in the best schools that isn't used in some of the others, and it could be. We don't provide much leadership training for high school principals and elementary school principals. We could. And if we did that, then we should give them hiring flexibility as well. I'd like to see, frankly, some increased discipline and respect for education in the schools that I think has gone south a little. And then finally, I would say that modern technology is providing all kinds of tools that can be used in the classroom that are really not being used yet, but will make education, I think, much more effective.
Talking about a lot of the interactive apps and things like that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we can make learning fun with some of those things, and we can get away from one size fits all. And then imagine taking a test on your computer, and based on how you answer the questions, it sends you to one set of readings if you did this well, and another set of readings if you did that well.
Yeah.
All of that will help, and that's coming.
And well, it's all certainly available right now if somebody wanted to do it. I mean, that's, you're not talking about anything that's terribly complicated to do for a savvy tech person.
Well, that's right. Yeah. But in order to do it, we have to commit resources in the right way to education.
Right. Nobody's going to do it for free, you know. All right, so let's talk about, well, I want to say one of the big ones, but they're all big here.
They're all pretty big.
Healthcare is something, you know, as everybody is going to have some sort of probably an unpleasant experience with the healthcare system, whether that's a deductible that they can't meet or not being able to make the premiums or something, or somebody's being denied a certain kind of coverage because it just isn't covered on their policy. It's a mess, really.
Well, healthcare in the United States is pretty good by international standards, but it's only pretty good. We spend 18% of GNP on healthcare. Nobody else spends more than about 10%. That difference, if measured in dollars, is over $1 trillion a year. And what do we get for it? Well, we don't seem to have better life expectancy. We don't have better infant mortality. We don't have healthier lifespan. We don't have less obesity. We don't have better morbidity. We're spending $1 trillion a year for which we're getting almost nothing. And $1 trillion is a pretty big number when you were talking about what we could use money for if it were available. This is where the money is. This is where the money is. This is where the most is wasted.
And what's it being wasted on?
Point to the places.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm mostly curious about. I mean, is it going to administrators of the insurance companies, or, you know, because obviously you want to have, if you're going to have a high class healthcare system, you're going to need to have very expensive procedures probably. So there's
right.
that. And there's pharmaceutical development that is going to make medication expensive sometime. But that's probably not going to be your $1 trillion.
Well, some of those things do contribute. But as you mentioned, marketing and administration is much more expensive in the United States than anywhere else. But by a lot. So there's a lot of money there to save. But pharmaceuticals are another place, because we're about the only country whose policies seem to be designed to raise the prices of prescription drugs rather than to lower them. We don't bargain with pharmaceutical companies. We have extremely pro-business patent laws. So we push up pharmaceutical prices and pay much more for drugs than anybody else. And then there's diagnostic testing. We do a great deal more of that than anybody else, a lot of it driven by defensive medicine and the tort system. And then the hardest of all of them, which is end-of-life care. But end-of-life care, while there are very difficult issues that I don't have solutions to in end-of-life care, I've got one, and that is we can ask people when they're healthy how much end-of-life care they want and then obey them. And we don't do that now. So people get a lot more end-of-life care in a lot of cases than they would want.
And it's very
expensive.
Yeah, and so much of that is happening. I can't remember the statistics that I read, but it was a very high percentage just happening all the last month or last 2 months. And
yeah.
I don't know. I think there would be a tremendous sense of guilt if you didn't do everything you could as the relative or primary caretaker of somebody who's towards end of life.
Except that we need to obey people's own wishes about that.
Yeah.
If somebody says, once my quality of life is gone and I don't want to be kept on a respirator, or when I'm for sure dying, I want to die at home with my loved ones and family and not in an intensive care unit, we should obey them.
James Stone, the author of 5 Easy Theses, Common Sense Solution to America's Greatest Economic Challenges. We only got through 4. There's one more. You're going to have to get the book to read it. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, well, I'm very glad to have been with you. Thank you.
My name is Ruth Roosey. I'm a retired teacher. I'm 91 years old, and this is how I live United. I say retired, but not really. Once a week, I read books to children as part of United Way's education program. Reading to a child creates links between language and literacy. It creates a bond between grown-up and child. And believe it or not, it prepares them for a better academic future. Oh, we read about frogs and flies and pigs with wings, all sorts of juicy stuff. It's a joy to watch all those little faces. I figure I have the time and they have the need. And I've always believed that if we're not here to help each other, then what are we here for, really? My name is Ruth Roosey. I help kids prepare to succeed in school. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org, brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Hey there, welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and it's time for an Ask Mr. Dad segment. And today's question is one that I get quite often from divorced parents, and especially during the summer. Dear Mr. Dad, I'm a divorced mom, and because of my past substance abuse issues, my ex-husband has primary physical custody of our children. I only get to see them on weekends, and we miss each other terribly. I've been trying to make it up to them by filling every weekend with outings and activities, but I think I've made a mistake. More than anything, I want to just hang out with the kids, but every time I schedule some downtime, they complain that they're bored. What can I do? I am so glad that you wrote. I get this question a lot from non-custodial dads, but it's important for readers to understand that when the roles are reversed, moms often experience the same problems. A lot of non-custodial parents, especially those with limited time with their children, fall into the same trap you did. Sometimes, like you, it's because they feel guilty about not having been around as much as they'd like to. Sometimes they're trying to earn their children's love, and sometimes they're trying to compete with their former spouse. The result is a non-stop party, filled with expensive gifts and trips, little or no discipline or responsibilities, and that means no homework or chores, and treating the kids like royalty instead of children. Hence the nickname, Disneyland Parents. As you've discovered, this model simply isn't sustainable. Eventually, you'll run out of money or ideas, and even if you don't, you'll end up with no relationship with your children. Plus, they'll be so spoiled that if you pull the plug on the fun, they'll think you don't love them anymore, or they'll resent you for taking away what they feel they deserve. Here's how you can turn back the clock. Pretend the kids live with you full time. That means making sure their homework is finished, chores are assigned and done, and that they do their piano practice. Also, try to schedule some one-on-one time with each child and some unstructured screen-free downtime, even if they claim they're bored. Have a reasonable amount of fun. You can't possibly entertain them every minute, so don't even try. Of course, some of your weekends are going to be packed to the gills with great activities, but don't make them all that way. Be normal. Accept that you may need to spend a few hours on a project from the office or doing some household repairs. Having the kids help out is a wonderful way to spend time together and makes them feel that they're a part of your life. It also reminds them that you're human and have obligations and responsibilities. Get their input. Ask them to put together a list of activities they'd like to do. You won't get to them all, but the fact that you've asked them lets them know that you genuinely care about what's important to them. Be normal. Some days you'll have tons of energy to run around all day. Other times you'll feel like a slug, just like everyone else in the world. Your kids will understand. You and they will occasionally have fights, too. Don't worry. The kids won't stop loving you. Fights are perfectly normal in intact families and just as normal in broken ones. As a non-custodial mom, your goal is to have as normal a relationship with your children as possible. There's no need to compete with your ex, and you don't need to buy their love. If you genuinely love your children and are interested in being with them, they'll know it. And they'll love you and want to be with you too.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.